Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, and this week's online video picks are up on our website. Each week we select five web videos, and I anchor them in a picks video on our site. This week's picks include 40 great speeches from the movies in a minute and 12 seconds. This is really fun. See how many of the movie clips you can identify in these 40 great clips from the movies, 40 great speeches from the movies in a minute and 12 seconds. See our online video clips at wnyc.org/video. Well, the new fighting between Israel and Hamas seems like the same old for the Arab-Israeli conflict in many ways. Terrorist missiles fired into Israel aimed at civilians. Israel going hard after the military infrastructure involved, but with many civilian deaths in the bargain as well. Polarized condemnation by supporters of each side, with some calls for mutual restraint. In the fighting in Gaza, an estimated 400 are dead, 1,500 wounded. It's a human tragedy, but is anything new here? Or is it just a pattern that neither side can break out of, a kind of double hell for Israelis and Palestinians yet again? Let's get the latest and some perspective from Chris Dickey, Newsweek's Middle East regional editor. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Always a pleasure, Brian.
I want to fill in some of the background details here for our listeners, because I think so many of the news reports just contain what's happening now, and people get too focused on that. Hamas broke a ceasefire with Israel on December 19th, but take us back before that. When did that ceasefire begin, and why did Hamas agree to it in the first place if it opposes Israel's existence?
Well, Hamas agreed to it under pressure from the Egyptians and other groups a little over 6 months ago, with the idea that it would last about 6 months. It started to deteriorate actually before December 19th. It started to fall apart over the last couple of months as there were more and more rockets being launched from Hamas-controlled territory, or ostensibly Hamas-controlled territory, into Israel, and the threats began to rise of retaliation. Part of the problem is that Hamas didn't think it was getting anything out of this ceasefire, out of this truce. And that's been a recurrent part of the picture as you talk about same old, is that there will be outbreaks of violence and there will be truces, but in fact nothing improves enough on the ground for the Palestinians or in terms of Israeli security for either side to feel confident and move on toward the next step of real peacemaking.
Do you think Israel had steps that they considered taking that would have allowed Hamas, in its own view, to continue the ceasefire, and decided that those steps were just too risky for Israel?
Well, it's conceivable that they might have, but they're the kinds of steps from release of prisoners to opening up the borders of Gaza and so on, that would require real leadership in Israel. And right now, that's exactly what you don't have and haven't had for quite some time. Israel is moving forward toward elections. There's a lot of competing political interests, a lot of posturing, and every one of the major players thinks it's better to look tough toward Hamas than to look like you're making concessions.
So do you think there's a presidential politics aspect to this military action?
Prime ministerial, absolutely. There's an aspect of that. I mean, Ehud Barak, the defense minister, certainly sees his way paved for a possible return to the prime minister's office. And I think that, you know, he's the one who's leading the show. He's the one who's talking about all-out war with Hamas. He's the one who's tending to make the toughest statements right now. But also Tzipi Livni, the foreign minister, she visited Cairo on Christmas Day, just really 2 days, hours even, before this offensive began. So she's very much involved. And of course, Bibi Netanyahu on the far right of the political spectrum wants to be seen as the toughest, most law and order toward the Palestinians kind of Israeli candidate.
What kinds of attacks did Hamas launch right after it broke the ceasefire, before Israel began this offensive over the weekend?
They were launching multiple rocket attacks, and one of the problems that they're facing right now in dealing with the Egyptians, there's a whole subplot here about anger toward the Egyptians by the Palestinians and groups that support Hamas, and the Egyptian anger toward Hamas itself. Because on Christmas Day, when Tzipi Livni was in Cairo, Hamas decided that would be a good time not to pursue talks to build or restore a peace or a truce, but to launch 60 rockets into Israel. I think the death toll in Israel now, although it's nothing like as large as in Gaza, still, for the Hamas to have killed four people fairly deep inside Israel with its rockets and to have terrorized a great many more, that's a real problem for any Israeli government, and you can see why they wouldn't want to tolerate it.
Now, you've mentioned Egypt a few times, and here's a development just in the last few minutes across our wires on the AP. It says the Egyptian president says his country will not fully open its crossing into the Gaza Strip unless Mahmoud Abbas's Palestinian Authority is in control of the border post. Now, of course, a lot of Gazans want to escape the Israeli bombardment by going across the border into Egypt. Egypt has basically kept the border closed so far and now says it will not open the border unless Mahmoud Abbas's Palestinian Authority. That's the Hamas government of Gaza is in control of that border crossing. What do you make of that statement from Cairo?
Cairo look even more complicit with the Israeli government at this point, because the Israeli government is pretty clear that part of the goal of this operation is to re-engineer the Palestinian government. The problem, as people like historian Tom Segev have been pointing out, however, is that Israel has been trying to engineer Palestinian governments throughout its history, and with little or no success, and especially when it tries to engineer the governments of its neighbors, for instance, in Lebanon, at the point of a gun or with a concussion of bombs. And so you have this situation where really it does look like the same old, but the different wrinkle is that the government of Mubarak seems to be openly siding with Israel in this effort.
Now, why would they do that?
Partly because of anger at Hamas, the feeling that Hamas is not moving forward, but also Hamas, remember, is actually part of the Muslim Brotherhood. It grew out of the Muslim Brotherhood, the very same organization, political group, that is the strongest opposition to the Mubarak government in Egypt. So there is an effort to undermine Hamas, to discredit Hamas, to eliminate Hamas. At the same time, there's an effort to undermine and discredit the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. So I think that's one, certainly part of the motivation. Of course, what's happening is this is giving the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt the opportunity to organize big anti-government rallies and raising tensions on the streets of Cairo itself.
Chris Dickey, Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek, my guest on WNYC as we talk about the situation in and around Gaza and try to fill in a lot of the facts as people, you know, develop your own opinions and perspectives on this. So with Cairo not in solidarity with Hamas there, would you say that the Arab world in general is less in solidarity with Hamas this time around than in the past with their conflicts with Israel?
Not really, no. I would say that there is a lot of solidarity throughout the Arab world with Hamas, and not just with Hamas, but with the Palestinian people who are constantly portrayed as being the victims of savage bombardments by the Israelis. I mean, if you are in the Arab world anywhere, or in fact in Europe, or any place that's carrying news that's coming directly from Arab sources out of Gaza, what you're seeing is not a lot about Israeli victories, but a lot about Palestinian victims. And you're not seeing the Palestinian leader, the Hamas leadership, which is mostly in hiding right now. So what are you seeing? You're seeing wounded children, wounded women, crushed buildings, frantic people in the streets. That's the image that's going out to the Arab world of Muslims under attack, not just the Arab world, in fact, the whole Muslim world. And this incites a lot of passion and a lot of anger. And that becomes, over time, that becomes extremely dangerous, not only in the region, but internationally.
But what about the Mahmoud Abbas Palestinian Authority government? Are they in support of this Hamas offensive? I'm sure
no,
they don't
support... No, they're not in support of the Hamas offensive. They're not in support of Hamas at all. But Abu Mazen is discrediting himself by sitting back and waiting for this to usher him into power. He the more he does that, the more he looks to people on the ground among the Palestinians as, well, maybe quisling is too strong a word, but as at least impotent, powerless to act on his own. And he can't be in a position where he waits for the international community or Israel itself to put him in power definitively in Gaza. He won't be able to rule even if he were able to achieve that. So I think that he's in a very, very bad political position right now.
What could he do?
Well, what he could do is what he's tried to do over time is negotiate with the Israeli government and hope that instead of the stick, there would be rewards, not for him personally, but for the Palestinians, that there would be improved quality of life for the Palestinians, fewer checkpoints, more open borders, better economic development, clearer direction toward a final settlement of the major issues that would lead toward a two-state solution. But none of that has happened. And as a result, he really doesn't have very much credibility left.
Israel left the Gaza Strip, ended its occupation unilaterally in 2005. Presumably, Israel does not want Gaza back, so critics cannot say this is a land grab or a war for colonization, as people have said in the past about other situations. Fair enough?
Oh, that's fair enough. Israel definitely does not want Gaza back. And Egypt is certainly not going to cooperate with Israel to the extent that it would accept the huge flow of Palestinian refugees that would be generated by any kind of reoccupation.
And yet it's reported...
That's a non-starter.
And yet it's reported that Israel is going after military, political, and academic targets in Gaza. If they're destroying the whole Hamas infrastructure, what do they expect to leave behind afterwards?
A lot of people. An awful lot of people, and what they hope will be a humiliated, if not decimated, Hamas leadership. But the problem with this kind of campaign waged from the air is that you run out of targets after a while. We've seen this with numerous bombing wars. I covered the Kosovo War in 99. After a while, they were just bombing the same things again and again and again. The other problem in Gaza is that it is a sea of children. It is one of the most densely populated places in the world, and the average age is extremely low. At lunchtime and any day, any school day, when kids go home to school, home from school to eat, the streets are just absolutely running like rivers full of children. So you can't attack any place in Gaza that is in the urban areas of Gaza that's not going to put at risk the lives of a lot of children. That's just one of the horrible truths of the situation there.
Well, one comment that's come in says Hamas is responsible for all civilian casualties because they operate from civilian areas. True enough?
Yeah, they're all civilian areas. What would the military areas be? The places where they launch the missiles actually tend not to be very densely populated. They're sort of out in the orange groves and various places. But the places where their offices are, where their infrastructure is, it's in Gaza. It's in Gaza City. It's in the refugee camps. And those places are going to be hit. Those are major targets of the Israeli operation. And those places are, believe me, literally surrounded by children, just as a matter of the way the population is distributed there.
Well, do you think Gazans generally then support the lifting of the ceasefire this month and the attacks that they must have known would draw a deadly Israeli military response of some kind?
You know, nobody wants this kind of attack, but I think you can't underestimate the power of defiance in the mind of the Palestinians at this point. A lot of them feel that that's really all they've got. And that is an element that I think is underestimated again and again and again. When you occupy people or when you imprison them, which in many ways is what has happened since the withdrawal of troops from within Gaza, Israeli troops from within Gaza, you create a mood of defiance that overrules all kinds of rational discussions and rational approaches to a problem. It's just rage and resentment. And these rockets are an expression of that rage and resentment. They're not a well-articulated policy for the end of Israel, heaven knows. They don't present any threat existentially to Israel as weapons. But they do present a threat in the sense that they encourage this defiant, unrepentant desire of the Palestinians to shed the burden of Israeli occupation or the presence of Israel along all their borders.
Well, the occupation of Gaza had ended, but a listener writes, please mention that there were sanctions imposed on Palestine, so it wasn't just that they were getting nothing from the ceasefire, they were getting less than nothing. Do you think that represents a widespread point of view?
Well, I think that's absolutely a widespread point of view, and it is true. Again, there was this effort to force Hamas into buckling so that then it could be replaced by what was seen as a better government. But remember, the Abu Mazen government came in after the death of Yasser Arafat. For a long time, the argument of Israel was, we can't deal with Fatah, we can't deal with the PLO, because Yasser Arafat is at the head of the organization. When he goes, then things will be better. Well, Abu Mazen came in, things didn't really get better. And as a result, when elections were held, his opposition defeated him. His opposition was Hamas, which came to power in 2006 in elections, and then drove Fatah and Abu Mazen's people out of Gaza at the point of a gun in 2007.
We have 30 seconds left, Chris. Do you see prospects for a new ceasefire? What could make this stop?
I think the crunch is going to come when the Israelis have to decide whether to go in with a land offensive or not, and Hamas has to decide how it wants to address that. There is some analysis in Israel that both sides would like to avoid that. But Israel is going to have assurances that it's not going to have 50 more rockets falling on Sderot and even Ashdod as soon as this goes into effect.
Chris Dickey, the Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek. Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC, will continue to cover this story tomorrow. We plan a dialogue between an Israeli journalist and an Arab journalist. That'll be on tomorrow morning's show. But coming up in just a minute, research indicates that some blind people can, in effect, see obstacles in a room. We'll explain and take calls from blind listeners. Stay with us.